I'm the one and only legendary Stardust Cowboy.
Wow. Are you a real cowboy?
Sure, I got a bunkhouse, just like yours.
Are you really from outer space?
Sure, just like you, buddy.
Are you really a legend?
Sure, just like you. If you get any closer to me, you won't be a legend.
Ah, would it be okay if we danced to your record?
Shoot.
Nah, we don't want to shoot anyone to your record. We want to dance.
Well, you can do that, too. Shoot at their feet and watch them dance.
Wow. Hey, can you say woo?
Woo.
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 I took a trip in a Jiminy spacecraft, and I thought about you. I passed through the shadow of Jupiter, and I thought about you. I shot my space gun. Oh, I really felt blue. Two or three flying saucers parked under the stars.
Hello and welcome back to Album, the Heathen Special, where Nick Pegg and I have been talking at considerable length about the 2002 magnum opus, Heathen. And given the fact that we've been having so much to talk about, we've split the podcast in two, and so what you have your hands on right here is part two. So without further ado, we shall proceed immediately with the second part of our conversation, beginning with Afraid. Well, let's leave Slow Burn right there and move now onto another cheery, light-hearted, up-tempo poppy number. That's right, it's Afraid. Now, was this also a track that was originally on the Aborted Toy?
That's correct, yes. And unlike Slip Away, which is a complete re-recording, the version of Afraid that you hear on Heathen is essentially, it is the Toy recording, but with some overdubs and some redos and some extras. But it is the same backing track as was recorded during the Toy session, with some new guitar lines and some new bits and bobs. Wonderful, wonderful Tony Visconti string arrangement on it. Now, you know, Tony Visconti, one of his signatures going way back to the 60s. Yeah. This is fantastic way with a string arrangement, and you know he did it on some very early Bowie songs like Let Me Sleep Beside You and Karma Man. Beautiful string arrangements, and this is
there where he did them. They were very, I thought they were slightly lush. I mean, but they hadn't been working together long.
No.
What I love about the strings here is that they're very cinematic. You know,
yes,
they're really adding danger,
texture,
and
that's right,
drama
at the right moment, pushing you up through the chords.
The song is a very, it's a gallop, isn't it?
It is. Yes, so it's another song of angst and self delusion. Dave, cool, blimey. It's an interesting one. That actually could have been a candidate for first single as well, couldn't it?
It would have been a very good single. I mean, I think it's got enough in there that it would have said tour de force.
Yes.
Visconti's orchestration, Mark Plati's guitar.
Yes. You know, it's got that wonderful sort of poppy, when I say poppy, I don't mean pop music. I mean actual, literally popping noises. Yeah. That sort of, exactly. It's almost like popcorn.
Was this the first album really that Bowie got his hands on Pro Tools and that kind of stuff? Because we can hear that if we listen to the textures and the layers. There's something, I mean, that is in itself quite reminiscent of the Bowie, of the Berlin era.
Sure, yeah.
Building up layers.
I think Pro Tool-y things were already happening around about Earthling time, but this is, certainly there's a kind of, it's interesting, isn't it? Because clearly there's digital stuff going on here, but also it's a very analog, you know, some of the synthesizers are very consciously are retro and analog, aren't they, on this album? There's actually quite a...
layers.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So, I mean, you just mentioned the poppy things, and that's something that's there in these tracks, these slightly sort of bigger tracks, where you have these sort of electronic, bleepy, crackly kind of textures. And
yes.
It adds so much to it. But then against that, then you have the purity of the strings.
That's right.
As well.
That's right. Yeah, no, absolutely. And yes, he's experimenting with his vocals as well in this. So going back for a moment to Slip Away, the beginning of Slip Away, his vocal slips in and out. If it's almost coming through on the radio or on a crackly television channel, isn't it? And then it suddenly goes clear.
First verse, his voice has got a slight sort of fuzziness to
it. And you see that, to me, that's it coming in from, you know, coming the transmission coming over, you know, and they're gradually arriving with...
He's saying things like, I believe in Beatles, for example, which to me was another...
Well, it's one of his little Lennon paraphrases, isn't it? Because, of course, John Lennon famously sang, I don't believe in Beatles, in God, yes. So that's Bowie having a little, you know, and of course, but you know, he's got form here as well, hasn't he? Young Americans has got that interpolation of "I Heard the News Today, Oh Boy," and you know, there are various other bits where, because John Lennon was a huge, huge influence on Bowie, you know, personally. What is he saying when he says "I believe in Beatles"? I mean, obviously, it is on a certain level. It is David Bowie having a little crack at us, but it's. Well, okay, if he's turning around what John Lennon said on that song, you know, maybe he is. Again, it's just maybe, you know, is it just part of that sort of staying within the conventional box? I'm not on a limb enough to say I don't believe in Beatles. I do believe in Beatles because they're the.
So he's turning in the rejection of all these things in on himself and sort of coming back. And what we discussed earlier about this heathen, going back to the title, the heathen.
Yeah.
Maybe it's revisiting that character, speaking from that character's. Perspective.
Yeah, could be. Yes, indeed. Yes, those sort of strange silvery eyes on the on the Heathen album cover. Maybe we should talk at some point about the design, because that is also just beautiful. It is one of the most beautifully packaged and designed of all Bowie's albums. I mean, the photography and the typeface and everything. But those eyes are. Bowie himself said that it was. On a certain level, at least, was a sort of visual pun because they were meant to look like fish eyes, and of course, the fish was the symbol of the hidden sort of the cryptic code. Symbol of Christianity by the early Christians when they, you know, that was their sort of code thing when they were being persecuted. So there we have a, you know, a straight down the line sort of religious reference. Those photos and things, we are, you know, they're religious paintings and icons that have had paint splattered on them and defaced. Mm-hmm. And there are also some books that appear in the packaging, which are, you know, very evocative. Freud's interpretation of dreams and Einstein's theory of relativity and Nietzsche, that is Die Fröhliche Wissenschaft, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Which is there on the, you know, and these are, you know, that's the book in which Nietzsche famously proposed, you know, the death of God. Mm-hmm. And so these aren't accidental. This isn't just sort of some... These are all very carefully chosen.
And explicit.
And also the whole of the lyrics and all of the credits and everything are in this extraordinary sort of crossed out typeface, which was created by this, again, another actually very significant first on this album is the first one for which the graphic design was done by Jonathan Barnbrook, who continued as Bowie's designer thereafter really... That it's really out there stuff. I mean, when the Next Day cover was first unveiled, people were just going, "What? What?" The Heroes cover effaced by in a way that's like the Heathen design taken to the next level. One can look at this cross. You know, there is. It's not, again, it's not just casual. It's not just, hey, that looks a bit cool. Mm-hmm. There is actually. So I mean, I take it to be a reference to Jacques Derrida, who wrote a lot about, you know, the sort of the notion of eventually, you know, we reach the cancellation of the written word and the end of discourse, mm-hmm. you know. So by having this sort of typeface just all crossed out,
major tip of the beret to...
Tip of the beret. It is indeed. It is indeed. And then these beautiful photographs. Again, another first. This Swiss-born photographer, Marcus Klinko, took the photographs, and his partner, Indrani, did the sort of computer enhancement on them. And those two and Jonathan Barnbrook had all worked on Iman's book that came out the year before. She did this big sort of large format book, collection of some of her photos and things. But it was called I Am Iman, and Bowie wrote a sort of foreword for it. And that's where, you know, I think that's where Bowie had sort of came across these people, and he immediately got them on board for Heathen. And the results are beautiful.
It's really extraordinary, isn't it? He's got this sort of silvery sheen.
Yes.
Skin, and this wonderful suit, this, it looks like a 1920s.
Yes, it's a very, suit. Yeah.
It's quite a well-known tailor, I think.
Really...
And he's looking in fine form. He looks really, really good as ever.
He does. He looks incredibly cool in those videos. I'll tell you another, again, foreshadowing Black Star the whole time. In a way, he, as I said earlier, you know, the beginning of this discussion, Heathen is kind of the beginning of the end game. Not that he necessarily knew it at the time, but you can look at it now in terms of the sort of structure of his career. I think those four last albums, Heathen Reality, The Next Day, Black Star, have a kind of, they stand together as a kind of a unit in a way. Mm. And if you look at the, you know, the packaging, the booklet for Heathen, you will also find a photograph of Bowie sitting at an old battered school desk, pen in hand, poised over a sheet of paper. Well, that's exactly what he did again in the Lazarus video, isn't it? Yes. Many years later, you know, that's him sitting at the desk, sort of frantically writing things down while there's still time.
Getting educated.
Yeah.
So now we come on to I've Been Waiting For You, the Neil Young cover. Bowie and Neil Young, there's quite a long history there, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. I mean, they didn't... they eventually knew each other, but they, you know, right from the word go, way back when, late 60s, early 70s, Bowie was a great admirer of Neil Young, and Neil Young's early work certainly influenced some of Bowie's early work. I mean, famously, Kooks is, yes, is the famous example on Hunky Dory, which Bowie, even at the time, sort of said, you know, he wrote that basically off the back of he'd been listening, yeah, to a Neil Young record. And it does sound quite early Neil Young-ish. There's another track from around about the same time, from Hunky Dory time, which was never, well, it was eventually released many years later, a song called Lightning Frightening.
Yes.
Which is, Lock, Stock and Barrel influenced by a Crazy Horse track, which sounds very, it's got exactly the same groove, that sort of, you know, and so, yeah, there was always that influence there. And then they kind of connected again, well, you know, several times over the years, but certainly in the mid-90s, they hung out together a bit. You know, Neil Young was very heavily involved in this, the Bridge School Benefit Concert, yes, which is a charity thing that happened every year, where Bowie played one year. I think Bowie played there in 96, didn't he? Right. When he was in his sort of outside going into Earthling period. And in fact, the song Dead Man Walking on Earthling was partly inspired by Bowie seeing Neil Young and his band performing at the Bridge School concerts. There's a line in Dead Man Walking about three old men shaking their sex and their bones, whatever it is. And he was kind of talking about Neil Young and his band doing this, doing their kind of moves on stage that they did.
Kind of jumping
moves. And the boys that they were. Again, Bowie being retrospective about, you know. So on Heathen we have this cover of I've Been Waiting For You, which is an early Neil Young. It's from his first debut album, his eponymous solo, 69, I think, 1969. And of course, Bowie had already done this song live. It was performed live on the second Tin Machine tour. With Reeves Gabrels, guitarist, Bowie's guitarist in Tin Machine, and for many years later in the 90s. Singing lead vocal on it. And interestingly, actually, prior to Tin Machine doing it, the Pixies of Cactus fame had also covered I've Been Waiting For You. It was a B-side of one of their singles in about 1990. So I don't know whether that influenced Bowie to kind of pick up the song. But
it's certainly a coincidence.
Yeah, it certainly is.
We had one big engagement with the Pixies in the previous cover version. And an interesting little nugget here is the fact that Bowie's actually doing the Pixies version.
It kind of is the Pixies, but you know,
they dropped half a verse somewhere and put it in after the chorus.
Yeah.
And Bowie's actually covering that.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? It's an interesting sort of move on from that. Yeah. And of course, there's another little bit of sort of Bowie's gang history in this, in that the guest guitarist on this track is Dave Grohl,
right,
who again had played with Bowie before, as had Black Francis of the Pixies at the Bowie's 50th birthday concert.
Is Dave Grohl there?
He played some guitar on some of the tracks as well there. Mm-hmm. So again, it was a kind of, you know, this is Bowie sort of bringing together some of his, you know, past collaborators and giving it. So yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I've Been Waiting For You on Heathen. I'll be honest with you and say it's not that I think it's a weak link, but if there was one track that I don't think the album would be any the less without, it might be this one. You know, three cover versions, as we said, on this album, and when the new material is as good as this, I have to say, personally, I find it slightly baffling that this track, which is great, don't get me wrong, it's a great track, but there are a couple of B-sides. Mm. There's a song called When the Boys Come Marching Home, which is
really
so beautiful and didn't make it onto the album. So it's one of those things where and Wood Jackson, another one. Again, what a weird song. Yeah, there's some wonderful, they did come out as B-sides, so it's, you know, it's cool, I don't mind. But maybe, as we were saying earlier on, it's this sense of the pacing of this album is terribly important to Bowie, that, you know, we've just had Slow Burn and Afraid, both quite sort of, as it were, heavy songs. Maybe it is time just for a bit of, you know, it's a cover version before we get on to the next one, which is definitely a heavy one.
It is a heavy one as well. I mean,
it's a heavy song. Neil Young song is a heavy song.
It's intense. I'm not a big Dave Grohl fan, and to be honest, this guitar could be anyone. You know, I don't think it's especially distinguished.
Yeah. I mean, it's got that sort of grungy, authentically sort of 90s-y feel to it, I guess, hasn't it? It's got that slight sort of Nirvana kind of wallop to it, a bit, but it's not. You know, it's all right. I quite like it. As I said, it is, you know, I don't want to damn it with faint praise, but if for some bizarre reason you were to hold a gun to my head and say which track should be removed from Heathen.
I'm actually now holding a gun to Nick's head.
Oh my God, it's a real gun. No, it's not. You know, it's cool. It's interesting, and he does it beautifully. He sings it fantastically, of course. It's got that wonderful production on it again. You know, it's the whole thing sounds great. I just
it's got a very key Neil Young motif in it about he's been looking for a woman.
Yeah,
you know, because Neil Young is often looking for a woman.
He is,
you know, a man needs a maid or heart of gold. You know, he's looking for that elusive woman in this song. And this song is, I mean, like you said, it's off the debut album in 68. It's a very naive song in that sense. And this theme comes back and back again. But then we also in this song have another recurring Bowie theme, which is waiting.
Waiting so long. You're dead right.
And it's interesting how these two motifs kind of meet up in this particular song.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? I think that's one of the things that probably always appealed to Bowie about Neil Young's songwriting, is that there is this kind of, I don't know what you call it, a sort of existential thread going through there. Yes, it's almost like waiting for Godot. That's sort of, the figure sitting, waiting for the thinker sits alone, growing older. That's a Bowie early type. That always felt to me like a bit of a Neil Young type line.
It's true.
And that's from Signet Committee. Yeah. I guess that is something that, you know, hadn't really occurred to me, the waiting. You're absolutely right that, you know, that yes, Bowie has a sort of a definitely, that's one of his motifs, isn't it?
You've been waiting for me such a long time now.
And of course, as with all of this album, there's a sense of, of stretching backwards and possibly forwards across the timelines and the sort of the weight of personal history, something that, again, he sings about a lot on the next album, you know, never get old. I think about this and I think about personal history. So it does actually fit Heathen very well. I didn't mean to be too, you know, I don't want to diss it too much, but it does fit. It fits well.
You're very, very generous and you're successful. So it'd be nice let rip and just be like, oh, for God's sake, go Paxman on his ass.
No. It's still David Bowie in his imperial period. So it's still great. Don't get me wrong. I love it.
What's next?
The next track is I Would Be Your Slave, which is, you know, back to absolutely double distilled Heathen. It's one of the heavy tracks, I think, isn't it? Another lovely Tony Visconti string arrangement, but this time not a sort of that sort of what swooping string arrangement on Afraid that, as you said, just lifts the song up and pushes it up through the clouds. This is a sort of very quivery, queasy, sort of slightly, crackling with sort of febrile tension of the
reminds me a bit of Word on a Wing.
Yeah, I think you're right. Now, this is, we were saying earlier on about Sunday, you know, that sort of, in a way, sets out the stall of some of the things that this album is going to do. By the time we get to I Would Be Your Slave, it sounds, you could listen to it and not get it. You could think it was a love song, a relationship song at least. It sort of masquerades in a way as a love song, but actually, of course, doesn't take a genius to work out that what it actually is a sort of a plea bargain with God, or with a God. You know, open up your heart, show me who you are. Open up your heart to me and I would be your slave. It's a kind of breast beating. So come on then, God, let's sort this out. What's going on? What's the deal? And it doesn't resolve anything. It doesn't come to a conclusion. It's just a sort of, it's quite anguished. I think it's quite anguished. It's a beautiful song. It has a sort of loveliness about it, but also it's quite a cold, rather.
Do you think?
Well, not, maybe cold's the wrong word, but
I would say cold.
Okay, not cold. I don't mean cold. I don't mean cold in the sense of. It sort of does make you go brrr a bit. That's what I meant. It's kind of, there's something slightly.
Not emotionally cold.
Not emotionally cold. No. Sorry, I didn't. Obviously, wasn't expressing myself well. That's right.
Mm-hmm. And they very mannered. And very graceful and elegant lines that they do play.
Yes.
And something you just said now really reminded me of, say, like when George Harrison, for example, was writing his songs around the time the Beatles split. You know,
there's
a lot of their God, show me. You know, he was very immersed.
Yes.
But he was at the beginning, really, of his big spiritual journey through the 70s there.
Yes.
And there's a lot of imploring God
to
reveal himself, show yourself. And Hinduism, which Harrison was immersed in, is littered with many examples of iconography where God reveals him or her or itself in various ways. And here again, we return to that theme of abasement, almost like abject.
Yeah.
What do you want?
Absolutely. It reminds me as well of the the metaphysical poetry of John Donne, mm-hmm. Which, yeah, I don't actually know whether Bowie was a great Donne fan, but I suspect that he possibly was, because there are echoes that, you know, and John Donne again was he's a fascinating writer, because the first part of his life was quite sybaritic and lots of love lyrics and things like that. Then suddenly he got, he got God, and then it's all about, the sort of batter my heart, all that stuff. And actually on Ours, which is a very sort of religiously inflected album as well, prior to, there's a line on there somewhere. It's in Thursday's Child, I think, isn't it? Where he sings, "Lucky old sun is in my sky," which really has the same, it has exactly the same scansion as "Busy old fool, unruly sun," which is a famous John Donne opening line. So there's that as well. Yes, I think you're right. I think that there is almost a sort of self-flagellating sort of, when I said I didn't, I'll retract cold and say sort of chilling. That's what I, or chilling, not, yeah, it's sort of chilling slightly.
In the sense that it's like a plea.
Yes.
But there's a negotiation. I would be. It's not I am your slave.
I would be. If you... How about...
Show me who you are, and I would be. Yeah. So there's a tension to it.
For what it's worth, there is also a remarkable echo from the most unlikely of sources in Bowie's past here. I don't know how familiar you are with his seminal 1986 Muppet movie Labyrinth, which I hope one day we might talk about, because I think it's a wonderful thing.
I'm the one Bowie fan that's never seen it.
You've never seen Labyrinth?
I feel...
Shows what you know, don't it? Sorry, that's a quotation. I'm just a worm. No. Oh, God, we've gone right off topic here. No.
This is why I'm not going to let you do Labyrinth, because I think it's going to be like 2 hours of you giggling and doing funny voices.
In the final confrontation, though, in Labyrinth, when Bowie confronts Jennifer Connelly after she's been through all the trials and been through the thing to get her baby brother back. No, not really. I won't tell you what happens. But it's a very, it's the big final sort of standoff between the evil Goblin King, David Bowie, and there is a very, I try not to go on about Labyrinth too much, but it's actually a very, it's quite a Freudian film. Bowie is hitting on her. He wants her to come and join him and be his goblin wife for all time. And just before the final denouement, he says,
"Just fear me, love me, do as I say, and I will be your slave."
Obviously, this song is not about Labyrinth. But it's interesting, isn't it? It's interesting with Bowie that there are always these echoes from the most unlikely, coming in from left, right and centre. Look at those cavemen go, just coming from everywhere.
I found a quote about it. Where he's saying, "It's an entreaty to the highest being to show himself in a way that could be understood, but too disturbing."
Right, there you are, very John Donne, isn't it? It's very, reveal yourself. I want to go along with it, but tell me what it is that I'm supposed to be going along with, because it's another, worrying me.
Another big John Donne fan in popular rockular history is Van Morrison, who, of course,
on
his own spirit, very tormented, frequently tormented spiritual path. Rave on John Donne. He references him quite frequently, especially in the mid-70s albums.
Interesting one, man. That is, isn't it?
Moving on.
So again, we were saying earlier on about the light and the shade, so I Would Be Your Slave, definitely one of the heavy tracks. And now we come to I think this is one of the highlights of Heathen. I love this so much. I took a trip on a Gemini spaceship. Now, I'm sure people probably know a bit of the history of this, but this was one of the songs that particularly had lodged with Bowie from way back when,
had indeed alleged
with Bowie, by the legendary Stardust Cowboy, whose little place in Bowie history is, of course, that Bowie took that's where he got the name Stardust from, for Ziggy Stardust. Now, what happened was he was a Texan. He was his real name was Norman Carl Odom, and he's this kind of crazy out there outsider artist in the sort of late 60s into the 70s. Well, he's carried on performing long after that as well, but that was his little period of, and he's this kind of weird mixture of space age rockabilly and stand-up comedy and utter surrealism and sort of almost semi, I mean, well, just crackers, just out there stuff. So there's a wonderful quote from him that someone asked him what his areas of interest were, legendary Stardust Cowboy, and he said something like, he said, "The Old West and space exploration. Everything in between is garbage and I'm not interested." So that was it. That was his shtick. Okay. And Bowie, when he first went over to America in 1971, he was on Mercury Records at the time. That was his label that brought out The Man Who Sold the World. One of the executives from Mercury Records, a guy called Ron Oberman, Bowie sort of told this story many years later, kind of sidled up to Bowie and said, "Hey, Dave, you like weird weird shit, don't you? And Bowie said, oh yeah, I love weird shit. And he said, well, David, this is the weirdest shit we've got. And he slipped in these singles by the legendary Stardust Cowboy. And of course, Bowie fell in love with them immediately. I don't know if you've heard any of the original recordings. They are out there. They are bonkers.
So sure, by the time this podcast is released and edited, I will have
yeah. Absolutely.
I might put some right here.
Yeah, yeah. So as was ever his way, you know, Bowie took this material and did something different with it, of course. But you can see immediately, you know, whether you listen to the original The Ledge, as he's known, the legendary Stardust Cowboy, his nickname, The Ledge, whether you listen to the original or whether you listen to Bowie's version on Heathen, you can see the heritage. It's not just that he took the word Stardust. It's not just that he was yet another of these crazy outsider artists that Bowie, you know, was so impressed by the sort of inherently how much sort of integrity it had because it was so crackers and so uncompromising, but also just lyrically, he was genuinely influenced by it. You know, there's a line in I took a trip on a Gemini spaceship. I shot my space gun. Boy, did I feel blue. I pulled down my poison visor and I thought about you. I mean, what a line. It's brilliant. But this is this not, you know, keep your electric eye on me, right, put exactly. your ray gun to my head, keep your space face close to me. You know,
Ziggy is immersed in this.
Absolutely, totally immersed in it.
It's
so
cheesy, metaphors, and double entendres.
That's right. But musically, I think it's fair to say he was not a huge influence. As I say, if you go back and listen to the original version of I Took a Trip on a Gemini Spaceship, it is bonkers. It's way out there. Bowie takes the lyric, takes the essence of the kernel of the song, and then creates a whole new soundscape. This wonderful, deliberately kind of corny sort of science fiction vibe. It's got and it's got this wonderful sort of groove to it. It's got these sort of wah wah guitars. It's all quite science fictiony, isn't it? I mean, the waka 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 guitars sort of reminds me of 70s sort of space 1999 music. Right. And then of course there's a theremin, which is total Forbidden Planet Star Trek sort of stuff, isn't it?
You know, you have to have created a whole musical universe for this song.
Yeah.
Because it came from such a sort of crackpot
original.
So it's the interpretive element goes way beyond interpreting the vocals and the lyrics to actually reimagining what
that's
the music
right.
could be.
But he's done it with such love. And again, as we were saying earlier on about Oogie and Burns Boy and Uncle Floyd, it's not a piss take. Yeah. It's a genuine tribute. It's straight and in the course of doing so, it's a great fun song. It's funny and enjoyable and lovely, and it is a bit of light relief. But at the same time, he somehow manages to create a sense of, again, of that sort of isolation, that whole Major Tom thing of the spaceman lost in, and the sort of alienation of that, which simply isn't there in the Ledge's original, bless it. You know, that Bowie it's actually quite moving. It's actually quite sort of. So, and Bowie's vocal on it, isn't it? He's kind of gone full Elvis on it as well, hasn't he?
I'm still thinking about what you just said now about him bringing this poignant element to that. And I can't say that struck me before. To me, it's always been a bit more of a jolly romp.
I mean, it is a jolly romp, but I think, you know, go and listen to it again in the middle eight when he's doing the sort of, you know, I jumped into my Gemini, you jumped in, whatever it is, and then they fly off and just ran the universe one more time or whatever it is. It actually almost kind of gets me a little bit. I think it's wonderful. And yet again, can I just, there's another little Black Star foreshadowing, just little techniques and things he's trying out on this song, as he does on Black Star very openly on the track Tis a Pity She Was a Whore at the beginning. He does that sort of heavy breathing. On this track, he's doing it again deliberately. During the song, he's up to the mic. You can hear him breathing. It's a deliberate thing. It's not sort of whoops, we can accidentally hear him breathing there. It's a totally full-on deliberate thing. And he's doing that wonderful sort of he's really playing around with his voice in it. He does that amazing sort of vocal fry thing as well, that wow thing.
That's the lowest note that he ever did.
Is it?
Yes.
Really?
That's the lowest recorded note he's ever done. Penultimate wow.
Yeah. You know, that's great. It's so cool, isn't it?
That's what made me think it's playful and it's.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it is playful. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I think the sort of the fact that it actually has a little tug is you know, I don't think you have to find that there, but I do find it there. I'll tell you something as well. We mentioned Meltdown earlier on. The release of Heathen coincided with Bowie curating the Meltdown Festival in London in 2002, in June 2002, and among the acts that Bowie got over to perform, and I was lucky enough to see because I went there that night. There was an amazing double bill of Daniel Johnston, the totally outside singer songwriter, and the legendary Stardust Cowboy. So he did a full set with his little band, and he did. I Took a Trip on a Gemini Spaceship his way. Yeah. And it was quite something, I'll tell you. It was
Daniel Johnston was there as well.
Daniel Johnston was there.
I thought Wood Jackson is kind of a Very
oblique. Yeah, I think that Wood Jackson, which was a Heathen outtake, released as a B-side in 2002. Yeah, it's one of the most peculiar, strange, cryptic little lyrics that Bowie ever wrote. But yeah, in as much as one can give it, there is a sense that it is quite possibly a well, if not about, then certainly sort of tipping an homage to Daniel Johnston, this very sort of outsider artist who made little tapes of his songs and sold them to people in exchange for comics and things like that. And Sis Jackson made 20 tapes in a day, isn't it? So yeah, it was an amazing double bill. It was actually The Ledge first, followed by Daniel Johnston, and it was a true meltdown experience. You know, that night, you know, that was a real avant-garde night of weirdness.
That wasn't the night where Coldplay played and then...
No, it wasn't. And then I forget the exact time scale of it, but a week or two later, Bowie, you know, headline closed the Meltdown Festival with his big concert of his own, where he performed the whole of Low followed by the whole of Heathen. And as he was going through Heathen, he talked about each song as he started. And when he got to that one, he sort of said, "So who was here? Who saw The Ledge?" And people, you know, put their hands up and things, and it was great. Because, you know, Bowie sadly wasn't actually there to see it, but he'd obviously, you know, it's been reported back to him how the show had gone, and it was great. I mean, it was bonkers, the Ledge show. He dropped his trousers at one point, hopped around the stage with it. Yeah. But it was great. And also, you know, it's the fact that Bowie covered it after all these years, you know, it's actually an act of wonderful kindness apart from anything else, because, you know, we're talking about songwriting royalties here as well as anything else, you know. And the other thing about 2002, of course, as well as Heathen and Meltdown, it was the 30th anniversary of Ziggy Stardust. Yes. And there was a 30th anniversary reissue that, again, was June 2002. This was all happening at this time. There was a kind of sense that Bowie was, as I said, the sort of like homecoming hero of British rock. And this was all happening at the same time. So this cover of I Took a Trip on a Gemini Spaceship just fits perfectly into all of that.
I think I read somewhere that The Ledge was introduced to Bowie backstage. He went to a Bowie gig. He was getting free tickets. He went backstage and Bowie was in a lineup.
Right.
And someone said, this is The Ledge recital. And Bowie just lost him. But he was like, The Ledge!
Yeah.
And went to give him a bear hug, and The Ledge stood back. And this bystander said that it was a slightly awkward situation because Bowie went to give him a massive bear hug.
Mm-hmm.
The Ledge stood back and gave him, just held him by the arms.
Ah.
And was a little bit cool with him.
Yeah. But
Bowie was gibbering like a fanboy.
Wow.
And I think there was, because The Ledge had been going on record saying, you know, it's great that David Bowie covers was it so inspired by Ziggy, but I haven't seen anything from it.
Yes.
And I think he said that he'd set up a basic website in the early 2000s.
Yes.
And was unable to afford a computer to look at it. So when word got back to Bowie's, team that this was the case, I don't know how true this is, but it's a nice idea that Bowie was so like, oh shit.
That he decided to record it for that reason. Well, it's a nice story if it's right. Yeah, and then it may well be part of it. And Bowie did say something like that, I think, at the time. Yeah. He did say, you know, I sort of was consumed by guilt
This is something interesting about, we've talked about this quite a lot in this edition, about his history of doing covers. And, of course, one aspect of this is that he's really materially helped people out.
Oh, yeah,
Iggy
Pop being the classic example. But many other, but absolutely. He sort of helped people he really, I mean, you know, another famous example being Mott the Hoople, who were about to disband. And Bowie said, oh, no, don't disband. I like you. Hang on. Have this song. Yeah, yeah. And he gave them one of the best songs he ever wrote. All the Young Dudes, of course. He did this. He was an extraordinarily generous.
Especially from the 70s pop scene, the cutthroat pop scene where everyone's a rival. This generosity.
Yes.
I mean, the way he helped out Lou Reed with Transformer,
yep.
And then Iggy, Mott the Hoople, Iggy again.
All sorts of people. And
covering this song, making sure The Ledge got a nice payday from that. Or even Biff Rose. I mean, did you see that Biff Rose documentary?
I haven't seen the Biff Rose documentary,
It was filmed about 3 or 4 years ago. And it's obvious that, you know, he's been getting regular royalties from Hunky Dory.
Yeah.
But it's quite funny. He's pretty dismissive of Bowie.
I have sort of, you know, seen quotes from him over the years and things. But Biff Rose is a fairly uncompromising character, I think.
Yeah. And now we come to the next cover, which is his cover of We Don't Talk Anymore by Cliff Richard.
No, the cover versions have gone, and so have the Angels. The next track, isn't it? That was almost like a link, wasn't it? Yeah.
And also the Angels, the BBC One Tonight.
Yeah, at 5:15. Yeah. 5:15. The next track, it's 5:15, The Angels Have Gone. This was one of Bowie's favourite tracks on Heathen. Yeah, he said several times this was one of, and he played it live quite a lot, you know. I mean, he did perform the whole of Heathen, as we've said, but some of the songs he then sort of dropped pretty much as soon as he'd done that whole thing of playing the whole album. But this was one that he kept on and
used to do. Very poignant sounding track. You know, yes. All this talk of, like, you know, stations, departing
trains. Well, it's another song about a loner sort of packing up and leaving town and moving on, which of course is a recurring Bowie motif, as we said. A new career in a new town, move on, can't help thinking about me, yet again comes back to my thoughts. So that's about a boy leaving home for some undisclosed sort of misdemeanor or reason. He's blackened the family name or something. This one, I think, is about, again, it's a bit like I Would Be Your Slave. It's superficially a relationship song. It could be. You could take it as that, you know, he sings We Don't, he does actually sing We Don't Talk anymore, doesn't he? I've only just realised why you said that. Yeah, he does actually sing that. But
you think I'd actually taken leave of my senses?
Yes, but I just went with it. I just ran. but no, but you know, so he does it, but it runs deeper than that, of course. What he's actually on about here is something bigger than that. It's, you know, it's again, it's a light, it's dashed hopes and it's aspirations, a sort of a crushed soul leaving home, moving on, catching a train because that life over there has not worked out. So maybe there's something over there, which of course is another delusion. You can't run away from something that's not, it's not there or there. It's within you, isn't it? So I think that's what it is. So it's a very, very sad song. It's a little bit like, I suppose a little bit like The Loneliest Guy again, isn't it? From the next album, a little bit.
I think The Loneliest Guy maybe does it with a little less obscurity.
Yes, yes. Maybe The Loneliest Guy is much more direct. Guy. Yes, yes, you get it. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's, so it is another one of the, as we're loosely talking about the light tracks and the heavy tracks, this is, you know, actually a bit of a sort of reductio ad absurdum, isn't it? But it is certainly one of the one of the heavy tracks on the album, and it's been, again, that's a very beautiful. We haven't really talked as much about some of the music on this album, have we? It's got a lovely sort of riff, that little dunk 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 dunk. It's, you know,
and Visconti, isn't it?
I guess it is, because that's, but yeah
bass motif,
just
holding it down.
Yeah, and again, sort of washes of synthesized strings and things. Yeah, it's a very beautiful song, a very reflective song. It again sort of just opens out and expands and re-explores the whole sort of. I mean, of course, Angel's describing his hopes and dreams for his life. This is what I take it to mean. But calling them angels, it obviously takes us back towards Heathen and Sunday and all the sort of religious imagery of the album generally.
It is one of the heathen tracks.
Yeah, it is. Really, yeah, one definitely. Of
the cornerstone heathen tracks. Why 515, do you think?
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's almost like Sunday. It could be a diary entry again, couldn't it? It could be sort of 5:15, and you know, catching a train. It's just the 5:15. But of course, there is that Who song, isn't there? Which it can't be ruled out. I get back to Meltdown when he played the whole album on stage at Meltdown. John Entwistle had just died the day or 2 days before, and he dedicated this song to John Entwistle that night, which was a very sweet thing to do.
Angels have gone, yes. Yeah. And that embedded Who reference as well.
Yeah.
And jumping tracks. I mean, station to station, trains.
Yeah.
It's a song I haven't been able to really penetrate. Like you say, it's so rich in illusion and potential meaning, but it's something that kind of washes over me and I haven't quite got to the heart of yet.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Well, isn't that great, though? Isn't that great? There's always more to find and explore.
Absorbing. It's like I said when I first... Until I understood about Uncle Floyd and everything, that's the same slip away.
Yeah.
Such a beautiful, emotional song.
Yes.
But you don't necessarily know who is Uncle Floyd or why he goes to see the Yankees, but you don't know any of that
stuff. Yes.
But still, there's something in the delivery and in the poetry.
Yes.
And it becomes abstract and it has just a very strong emotional connection. Yeah. That's what I feel with this.
Yes, absolutely. I agree with it. And also, you know, it's coming up next is another towering example of the same thing, this sort of almost wrong footing idea, that because the next track is Everyone Says Hi, which, you know, is quite one of the sort of better known songs on them because it was released as a single. It was actually sort of Heathen's biggest hit. It went to number 20 in the UK charts. So really? It did. So it kind of did okay, Everyone Says Hi.
I know it was popular, but I didn't
it did okay. Mm. Now, you know, lots of people probably thought it was just Everyone Says Hi. It's like the theme tune from Friends or something. Or it was, you know, some people suggested maybe it was a kind of sequel to Kooks, and it was because it does have similar sort of, you know, ideas in it. If the, there's got a line that almost sounds like the, if the homework brings you down, it's not quite. But anyway, no, wrong. It's a song about bereavement, clearly. It is a song about the absence of someone. I mean, at the time that it came out, Bowie talked about the death of his father. Yes. His father had died back in 1969, around about the time that Bowie was recording the Space Oddity album, when Bowie was a very young man. He was only 22. And in early 2001, around about the time Bowie was writing the songs for Heathen, his mother died as well, as did his old friend Freddie Beretti, who had designed his costumes many years before and worked with him and things. So, you know, it was a sad time for Bowie. You know, there had been you know, bereavements, as well as the joy of his new daughter coming along. There had, you know, this was counterpointed by,
we,
you know, it's
a, we did
yeah.
petitions before, but surely as much as things like the birth of his daughter, the general political atmosphere, so these deaths must have added their weight to the tapestry.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. So when in Everyone Says Hi, he's singing, you know, said you caught a big ship, said you sailed away. It's not kind of, hey, bye, come back soon. Well, it kind of is, though, but it's that
they said
it's that idea of you know, there is that famous poem that is often read at funerals, isn't there, about sort of, I've just gone into the next room, whatever that poem is, which actually I find it a little bit icky, actually.
Don't grieve for me.
Yeah, that one, yeah.
Because if you've lost someone at your funeral, you'll be like, shut up.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm grieving.
Yeah, but Everyone Says Hi, I think it's a kind of like a rather more profound and heartfelt variation on that sort of idea, though, isn't it? Because it is sort of, he's singing to someone who's just kind of, who isn't there anymore, mm-hmm. but he's sort of pretending they were. Love to get a letter, love to hear what's what.
Has that kind of chilling thing of somebody in the first stages of grief?
Yes.
You know, the denial. They say you've gone away. They say you're on a big ship.
Yes.
And even the way it's being sung, you know, with this deceptively sunny, bright...
Yes.
Bouncy melody.
That's right. And that nostalgic feel. It's got the sort of doo-wop-wop vocals, the sort of absolute beginners things, you know, so that, which,
read in the slide, that makes it all the more remarkable because it becomes even more unsettling.
Yes.
You know, because it's just the refusal to accept that someone's gone.
Yes.
Or perhaps really knowing that someone's gone.
Yeah.
And just doing everything you can to block it out.
That's right. It's got jokes in it, which is the extraordinary thing. You know, at one point he says the guy upstairs. Well, you know, and the guy upstairs. And hope the weather's good and it's not too hot. I mean, yes. Are you upstairs or are you downstairs? These are gags. Yeah. But it's you know, that's Bowie through and through, isn't it? That's
some awful realization has been kept at bay just by a bouncy melody,
exactly.
Some gags.
Yeah.
This distancing, and again the distancing. They say you've gone away. It said it happened quietly.
Yes.
They say.
There's a kind of desperation to it, isn't there?
They say.
Yeah, yeah.
And, it's a funny one because it's one of those classic examples which rockular popular history is littered with, of songs which are deceptively sunny
but
carry a much more, darker or deeper...
That's right, yes.
I remember I saw him on this tour in Manchester and this was the... Everyone says hi. And you've got the audience to do this.
Sort of wave, light as a loft sort of thing. Yeah, yeah.
And there's this big cheery sing along.
Yeah.
And the guy upstairs.
Yeah.
And the big red dog.
But
obviously, that's part of the thing, this communal, everybody sing along. And it's very easily misinterpreted, as you mentioned earlier, but certainly one of the most intriguing songs on the album.
But that in itself is very Bowie, isn't it? It's quite subversive. It's very Bowie. But even, you know, going back, you could look at 100 other Bowie songs and say similarly, you know, I mean, Let's Dance is a classic example. I mean,
that
if you actually listen to the words, Modern Love, absolutely, they're desperate words of sort of existential, spiritual angst on the highest level. But it's, you know, it's kind of Let's Dance, dancing as a sort of defence mechanism against the awfulness that's going on around.
This is happening, but Let's Dance.
Yeah, exactly. Let's face the music and dance, I guess. All of that sort of. It is a sort of lovely, pretty song as well. Everyone Says Hi, I mean, as is Let's Dance. But brilliant.
Wasn't that produced by, what's that production?
Everyone Says Hi?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, this is interesting, actually, because unlike most of the album, as we've said, was recorded at all our studios up in upstate New York, after the main sessions... the album was mixed at Looking Glass in New York in around about October 2001, going into November, where they did some reworking on Afraid. And that's when Everyone Says Hi was recorded. It wasn't recorded up there.
So but at the very end of the session.
That's right. It was recorded at the end of the session. But then, not only that, but it was then sort of sent off to some guys in London who, you know, just for that track, some extra bits and bobs were added there. Fantastic keyboard player called David Clayton, who I actually worked with quite recently. I made an album with a musician called David Polfferman a while ago. Decades. Called Decades, and David Clayton played keyboards on that, and an absolute. He's played with everyone. He's played with Simply Red and goodness knows who. But yeah, he plays the synth on Everyone Says Hi. So yeah, that was a little different thing on the on Heathen, you know, from all the other tracks. Yeah. But it's lovely. I love it. It's another. It really, again, just sort of opens up the canvas of this album. It's not all just sort of, you know. It's got so many different tones of, you know, and modes of address and modes of expression. And Everyone Says Hi, I think it's a really interesting one. It just keeps on. Every time you hear it, it builds a little bit more into the fabric of the album.
I'd say a very counterpoint to some of the more profound meditations.
Yes, exactly. You know,
it still has heft. It still has plenty of substance to it.
Yeah.
But presented in a different way. It's not a cover.
That's right. And positioned as it is quite near the end of the album, because at this stage we've only got two tracks left.
Yeah.
It's almost like the last blast of, the next one is quite up-tempo too, but it's a lot more directly morose in its tone of, lyrics.
I'm intrigued with the lyrics. I find the melody quite nagging. I don't know if that's in...
This is A Better Future when I'm talking about. Yeah. Oh, look, I love this one. I know it's...
Really?
Yeah, I'm aware that it's a track that some people think is one of the weak ones on this. I think it's great. I know what you mean. It's very, it's got this sort of very metronomic sort of... And then it's got this little descending synthy line, which sounds a bit like sort of, do you know the way to Santa's yam bam 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 bam. It's a little bit like that, yeah.
So it's like the horns that we were talking about.
I think it's all part of the sort of subversiveness. It's actually almost a bit of that Everyone Says Hi spirit coming through again, that it's this sort of jolly, dinky song that you could almost put on in a club and expect people to get up and dance, but the words are another thing altogether.
We've been having these conversations with God throughout this album.
Yeah,
we've been having these conversations with the higher being or the spirit or the guy upstairs. And in this one, he kind of gets down to it and now listen.
Yeah, now listen, mate. No, absolutely. Even more directly than on I Would Be Your Slave, this is another sort of harangue to God. It's another rebuke, you know.
Either my better future or I just might...
I might just stop needing you. I might just stop loving you. You know, all of these things.
And this is the heathen.
And of course, this is... I think here, more than anywhere else on the album, we hear him fearing for his... child's future, you know, for that. I mean, it has, you know, give my children sunny smiles. Yeah. But he's clearly thinking about his baby daughter and what's the future holds. He's addressing God directly, and it's quite, you know, it's funny, isn't it? Several years later, there was a certain amount of controversy about his video for The Next Day, which, you know, some people considered to be very offensive. The title track from the album The Next Day, that which had sort of lots of religious sort of Catholic iconography in it, the one with Gary Oldman.
Do remember there being a fuss.
There was a bit of a fuss about it, but that's another story for another time. But here, you know, if anyone chose to listen to A Better Future, I don't know whether he might have if it had been waved under the noses of the sort of people who get offended about these things, they might have actually found it quite offensive. I don't find it the slightest bit offensive, of course, because I'm not someone who gets offended by things. He's threatening God, basically. Yeah. He's saying, listen, mate, do better. Must do better. Otherwise, I'm off.
Ricky at this stage, then.
I've got
Bowie on my case.
But no, I think it's got... And the fact that it's quite a catchy little number, I think it's great. I think it's a really great number. It's another one that he dropped quite early on live. He only played it again on the first couple of dates of this 2002 tour, and then didn't do it again after that.
How many pop songs include the word asunder?
Asunder, yeah. Please don't tear this world asunder. Yeah.
Asunder's a great word. It's not often used. But again, I think it's part of the grace and the elegance that runs like a silver thread throughout this album. You know, there's a certain quality, there's a certain standard.
Yes,
in the writing.
Yes, there is. There's a very. It's It's not overworked, I don't think. No. It's quite spontaneous. It feels quite spontaneous. But there is, absolutely. There's a sort
it
of...
It could very well be an album that, in the hands of a Sting or a... Well, okay, let me not name names, Bono. But in the hands of in the hands of another performer, could have easily toppled over under the weight of his own self.
It could have been, absolutely. It could have been. It could have been absolutely insufferable. Yes. It really could have been.
In this album, it's this ongoing dialogue with himself and with the higher power.
Yes.
And am I heathen? Projecting from a place of identifying as heathen.
Yes.
And I feel that very strongly in this song.
Yes.
It still has that edge of elegance and of restraint.
Yes, I think grace is, which you said earlier, that's a very good word. That's a very good choice of word. Yes, there really is. Yes, yeah. So no, I like that one very much. That's a good track. And okay, and yes, and it's almost like a little breather before the final onslaught, which is the extraordinary final track, the title track.
Should we
heathen the rays?
Go at the onslaught.
Yeah.
Are you ready to face the onslaught? Do you believe? Put your hands together now.
It's the last track.
How do we end up? So we've been through these various, we've cycled through a number of different ideas, perspectives, arguments, debates, lack of faith, having faith, qualifying faith, and then we arrive at heathen, the rays.
Yeah.
It's, like you say, this onslaught, this massive storm and drag.
Yeah. Feeling. I think it's one of the most raw. I'm hesitating to say personal, but sort of penetratingly frank and open lyrics that he ever wrote. Mm. It's right there, laid out in front of you. It's it's quite rightly as the final track on the album because it's the culmination of everything that's come before, and it's a song of which he wrote many over the years. But this is one of his really crucial songs, I think, about dying. Mm. It's about him. It's about his awareness that he is going to die. And he's in the song, he is addressing life, as a character. Yeah. So, he's singing to someone, and who he is singing to is life, his livingness, his existence. And he's feeling his life ebbing away from him as he sings it. This is one of the songs that he wrote up in the Catskills, looking out over the forest and over the mountains at 6 o'clock in the morning, apparently. And he said, when it just came to him, the words, it went down very easily, but he didn't feel comfortable writing it. He didn't want to write it, but it was just coming out. And he said there were tears pouring down his face as he wrote it. There it is. You say you'll leave me, and when the sun is low and the rays high, I can see it now. I can feel it die. It's a song about a man feeling his life ebbing away from him, and knowing that isn't a damn thing he can do about it. And the pain of leaving all of that behind, there's things I haven't finished, there's things I haven't done. And it's set against this sort of monumental backdrop of guitars and synthesizers, ambient guitars again, David Torn doing wonderful stuff, and these synthesizers. It starts in almost quite serene sounding, but then suddenly you get this sort of big sort of wall of synthesizers, almost like something off the Berlin albums, coming in, and it's dramatic and it's frightening and it's sort of almost Wagnerian. But as you said earlier on about the album, it's also under control the whole time. It doesn't go. It could have been bombastic and ridiculous. It could have been absurd, but it isn't. It's extraordinary. It's so immaculately judged. Yeah, very controlled. When he performed this live, he did a wonderful little sort of. Belittles it to call it a routine, but he did this extraordinary thing where he did the song, and then of course it ends on a big sort of instrumental play out, and he would put his hand over his eyes as though he was sort of blind, as it were, and Gail Ann Dorsey, his bass player, sort of led him off stage as though she was a sort of guardian angel or an angel of death, and it was rather like the one in Look Back in Anger all those years before or something like that. And they were basically acting out he has died and she's taking him off, and she led him off stage. Wow. And then they, had a little break there, and then he'd come back and do some more. And it was the most affecting thing. It was very simple, really, but an extraordinary thing. It was clearly a song that meant a lot to him.
The rays.
Yeah.
I mean, raging against the dying of the light.
Yeah. Absolutely that. That's exactly, that's a key reference, I'm sure. Interestingly as well, the original plan in Bowie's mind was that this would be the final song in the Lazarus stage show.
Oh, really?
Which would have been an incredibly downbeat ending. I don't know if you saw the show, but
I haven't seen the show.
Well,
knowing the song.
Yeah. The various other people, including, you know, the director and the musical director and various people sort of they sort of went, do you think that might be a bit, you know, sending people out slashing their wrists? And they eventually, you know, he was persuaded for better or worse to change it to the final track song of the Lazarus Show was eventually Heroes. It was a very sort of downbeat lo-fi but acoustic still, version of Heroes, but it still had an uplift. Now this would have been
everyone's falling out
in tears. Yeah, absolutely. But I have to say, you know, pound for pound, I think it sounded to me like a fantastic idea, and I would have liked to see that. But that's, you know, I'm with Bowie. Let's push this to the edge. But it would have been a very intense... No, it didn't appear in the show at all in the end. Yeah, right. But it would have been such an intense ending. It really would. But yeah, it's... I have to say, when I first heard Heathen back in 2002... I think I was almost slightly disappointed by the fact at the end of this track that it fades rather than ends on a big bang. But of course, as the years have gone by and I've listened to it again, I've realised, no, that would be totally wrong. It shouldn't end on a great big chord. It needs to fade away because that's exactly what it's about. It's about not with a bang, but a whimper. That's exactly what it's about. You know, it's again, we've talked about T.S. Eliot and Bowie a lot, but, you know, that's a... that's what it needs, absolutely. It's inconclusive. It's the end is not... the final chord of a great big Beethoven symphony. The end is just a trickling away. That's what it is.
Death. I mean, death is not that big climactic moment. Death is just an unknown.
That's right.
How can you ascribe something so unknown and misunderstood to one big explosive climax?
Absolutely.
It doesn't work.
And Bowie talked a lot about, at the time of this, about the fact that he'd been listening to the four last songs by Richard Strauss, which are the most extraordinary. Again, written by a dying man. Mm. You know, in reality, Strauss was dying. He was in his 80s when he wrote them, and they are the most extraordinary pieces of, you know, raw emotion. And Bowie had been listening to them a lot while working on this album, and I think that's another that's a very useful sort of index, a very useful thing to go and listen to get a take on what he was doing on Heathen as well. But yes, it's interesting, of, you know, being Bowie, he'd been listening to Strauss's four last songs and Mahler and things like that, but he'd also been listening to Moby and Air and Beck. Clearly you could say, and Beck and the legendary Stardust Cowboy, you know, so and this all goes into that fantastic Bowie melting pot, doesn't
and
it?
And this is what we get.
I think it's, you know, listening to it again before this conversation, it was actually the first time I've listened to it for a few years, because it's, you know, I know the albums so well that I sometimes just have to put them to one side for a bit, otherwise I don't. And so this is probably the first time I've listened to Heathen for maybe 5 years. And I was actually quite taken aback at how extraordinarily strong and brilliant I thought. I knew I liked it, but I listened to it again yesterday and thought, bloody hell. I think it's one of his great albums. I think it's right up there.
It's definitely an album which has grown in stature, I think, over the years.
Yeah.
It's acquired a patina and it's acquired... a status, a legendary status,
yes.
I think. I mean, I've always found Reality, which followed fairly soon on its heels, to be slightly the lesser of the two. It seems a bit less than this. I'd said to you earlier, I've read that Tony Visconti actually did categorically say that this is Bowie's magnum opus.
Yes, I remember he did say this. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, you can't do a Heathen every time, I don't think. That's it. And Bowie didn't. And there's sort of form for this, isn't there? He would do a very crafted, very, you know, quite sort of epic studio album. And then perhaps, you know, and then follow it with one that was slightly more sort of built for the road or something like that. You know, yeah, absolutely. Reality was written and recorded with a view to the fact that he was going on a world tour. You could look back at for example, Outside followed by Earthling, similar sort of thing. He recorded Earthling with his live band that had been out on the Outside tour, and Earthling has got a much more sort of spontaneous, sort of woomphy feeling to it. But and it's a great album. But Outside is more like a Heathen sort of an album, isn't it? It's a much more studied sort of and you could even say the same about something like Ziggy Stardust followed by Aladdin Sane, for that matter. You know,
that's definitely true.
Yeah,
I mean, to me. Aladdin Sane is the album. It's twice the speed of Ziggy.
Yeah. You
know? It's like boom, boom, boom.
Yeah. Zoom. And it's got that feel of sort of 1, 2, 3, go.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a great album.
There are quite a lot of these. This sort of couplet, you know, you've got the heavy one, then you've got the slightly more lightweight one following afterwards. But Reality is a whole other kettle of eggs.
It's a whole other nest of vipers. Another story for another day. Yeah.
Without being rude,
yeah, yeah, absolutely.
For now, given the fact that we've been talking for a long, long, long time.
We have.
We'll pause here. But as ever, Nick, thank you so much for coming along and for sitting in this basement with me, which you are incidentally now free to leave.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, thank you as ever for having me along. It's been an absolute pleasure talking about this album and kind of rediscovering it.
And that was Nick Pegg and myself talking at considerable length, quite deservedly so, I think, about Heathen, a most amazing album and definitely one of my favourite albums. And going on the response we had to part one of the podcast, yours too. So please do keep sending in your comments and your thoughts on Heathen, whether you think it's a classic, whether you think it's a bit overrated, whatever you think, just let me know. And I will be back as soon as I can with the next episode of Album to Album. And in the meantime, as ever, if you enjoyed the podcast, please do like it and share it. Let me know via Twitter, massage my poor old ego. It all really, really helps. And so follow us also on Twitter at Album to Album, ditto Facebook and Instagram. Till next time then, thanks for listening and goodbye.
I thought about you.